Dr. Matthew Shabbat, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's really great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. I'm glad to be back.
Last time we spoke, you were talking about, it was probably 6 weeks ago, and it seems like so many things have changed since then. But we wanted to bring you back because I think there's so much confusion around what's going on with the antibody tests. You know, are they effective? Are they available? And if so, should we only trust certain tests? And once we take them, what about the false negatives or positives? So why don't we just start with what you can tell us about today, May 13th, and what you can tell us about antibody tests?
Great. Yes. And I'm really excited to talk about this because I think it's an important question. It's a question I've been getting a lot from people that come to my clinic. So I can really speak to the specifics of the test we use at the University of Utah, but there are several antibody tests, many of which have received FDA approval through emergency means. So I can't necessarily speak to all of those, but I can speak to ours. But for antibody tests in general, what they are looking for is, of course, antibodies showing that your immune system has seen the COVID-19 virus at some point. And we know that these antibodies take somewhere between 7 to 14 days to develop, and then they persist for some unknown amount of time, but we can assume that this is weeks or months based on other diseases. So these tests are reasonably accurate compared to other tests that we have. They have sensitivity and specificity in the upper 90s, but what that means is that they will report false results. Sometimes we think of it as they'll report a false negative approximately 1 to 2% of the time, and a false positive somewhere from 4 to 5% of the time. So by
that
standard,
pretty good. I mean, that's good, because considering that the tests we're taking, the COVID tests to find out whether we have a confirmed case or not, you know, have false positives false negatives up to about 40%, as I understand.
Yes, that is true. And therein lies a little bit of the problem with a lot of these numbers, because to decide how accurate your test is, you have to compare it against a gold standard. And we don't really have a gold standard. So these tests where we say that we catch, you know, 95% of COVID tests in people that were defined as having COVID by the swab. So what if the swab was wrong? Are we comparing, you know, really true results? So, but that said, using the best information that we have, we think that these are really pretty accurate. But at the same time, I think the bigger question with antibody tests is, what are we trying to show? And I think if you're a public health researcher, or, you know, if you're the Utah Department of Health, let's say, and you want to take a couple thousand random people and test them to prove where the virus is or isn't, that's important. But if I am a random person off the street and I go to my doctor's office, they can order this test, but what's it going to do for me personally? And I think the big important thing for people to know about the antibody test is the antibody does not prove that you are protected from the virus, and it doesn't mean you get a free pass from doing, you know, all the social distancing and masks and hand washing that we want everybody to do. There have been some case reports of people getting the virus twice, although people are still trying to figure out if that's real. And I always have this conversation with people to say, yes, we can test you for antibodies, but if it's positive, what are you going to do differently? You might just say, well, I knew I was really sick back in March, and now I know it was COVID, and maybe you get bragging rights. But at the same time, that's not really like a reason to do a test. I think the really good reasons to do this test are if you're in a randomized study being conducted by a public health entity, that's a good reason to do the test. Or if you could conceivably donate antibodies, which I think is an interesting new possibility, So there have been some studies showing that people who donate their antibodies once they've recovered from an infection, those antibodies can be an effective treatment, maybe. Those treatments are still under investigation. And I think here in Utah, there is limited ability to donate those antibodies, and there are limited places that are actually giving them out. For example, the last I heard from the experts at the University of Utah, they had not yet administered any antibodies. I think at Intermountain, the situation is actually different, and they have done some of those in the setting of a study. So potentially, if you found you had antibodies, maybe some researcher somewhere would come looking and say, we would like you to do a donation, which would be a blood draw. But we're so far away from that being like systematic that I think that's a long shot. So so really, these tests are not ready for everybody and anybody to have one. And under rare circumstances, I think they're useful. They will probably also be useful for an eventual vaccine, which is, you know, the optimistic forward-looking way to think about it is when we get a vaccine and we can give it to someone and then we can prove that they've made antibodies, that will be an important part of this test, probably. So
if you look at infectious diseases and you look at the antibodies that the body builds, which is, you know, sort of coming from your own natural immune response, why are we seeing that the antibodies, and you know, maybe just speaking across all diseases, that the antibodies don't protect you necessarily from getting, you know, from having the harmful effects of the virus a second time or a third time, or it doesn't necessarily give you immunity?
I think that's the million-dollar question. And it's possible that there might be a partial immunity, or it's really unclear. The concern stems from other coronaviruses that, you know, besides this new one, you know, we've had coronaviruses before. And for those coronaviruses, it is possible to get repeat infections. And the thought is, you know, your antibodies can attach to the virus, but the virus can easily change proteins that are on its surface, and not all proteins on the surface of a virus are created equal. So some of them are more or less lethal when antibodies latch on. There's all sorts of, you know, theories that you could make about this. But, you know, infectious disease experts have seen this across different diseases. Certain diseases happen multiple times, and some are really a once-in-a-lifetime event. The details of that are complicated and different for every case. So
let me ask you about this, Dr. Shabbat. It's if you're talking about partial immunity, so this would be akin to, you know, I've heard about vaccines that, while they may not keep you from getting the infectious disease, you know, be it varicella, chickenpox, or like whooping cough, or something like that, if you do get it and you contract the disease, it will be a much lessened severity.
Right.
And so when you're talking about that partial immunity, is that the same thing that you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. So the second case of COVID hypothetically could be much less severe. And, you know, you mentioned varicella or chickenpox, and that's a great example that, you know, it is still possible to get that or other diseases after infection, although rare, but the cases we do see are generally much less severe because your body already has this armamentarium of antibodies ready to go, and there's not the ramp up period when the virus is actively replicating unchecked.
Right. And so then kind of going back to what you're talking about, and I think we see this a lot with the flu shot, for example. So the flu shot is developed and it protects against X strain, but it may not protect against these other strains, and you never know what the strain is for this particular season. And does that have something to do with what you mentioned, how the proteins change on the virus and make it turn it into a different virus before
Well, in concept, kind of, but I don't want to go so far as to say there are different strains of this COVID-19. I don't think that's been proven, but yes, we know that viruses change and adapt over time. So it is a little bit of a moving target. And in terms of like the flu vaccine, we know that each year is going to be different because the flu is constantly mutating and different strains are becoming more or less prevalent. It'll be interesting to see what becomes of COVID-19, if it moves into sort of a place like the annual influenza, where, you know, it's this constantly moving target, or if like other infectious diseases in our like history that, you know, it's a one clear target and we can develop an effective treatment and then, you know, vastly lower it or potentially eliminate it. But these are all so far in the future. It's hard to say, of course.
Right. So, but what we do know, or correct me if I'm wrong, about COVID-19 is that, you know, we hear it talked about as stable and it doesn't mutate a lot. What can you tell me about that? You know, I'm throwing out words that I've read and probably a lot of other people have read, and we don't know really as non-medical professionals, we don't know what it means. So that's where you come in.
Well, I can say that there's been minor variations in the genetic code such that people who have sequenced the virus have been able to track those. I'm not aware of any functional mutations such that like it becomes a categorically different infection. Mm-hmm. It's only been around for a few months, and I think it's really too early to say if it will mutate. And I think, you know, when we talk about viruses changing, this is largely conjecture and not proven on this one.
Yeah. Okay. So back to the antibody test, you know, what you've said and what I've been reading recently kind of tells us that it's not extremely useful information. It's more probably satisfying our own curiosity about, wow, you know, back in early March, I had this, you know, a couple of days, week that I felt really bad. And I think it was before it made it to Park City or Summit County. Did I have it? And I've talked to a lot of people who have, you know, sworn that they had it because they had all the symptoms. And maybe it's just, I mean, beyond satisfying our curiosity, it helps the research and the sort of the stats behind it. I mean, what else does it tell us?
I think, I think it's really research-based, and what it tells you as an individual, I think, depends very much on your situation. And I'll admit, while I have gone back and forth about the utility of it in an individual person, I've had patients, you know, beg and plead with me for this test, and I say, well, if you understand the limitations of this test, I guess in the end, I'm not going to stand in your way. But I think in this era where medical resources are scarce and exposure, even to the lab tech who's drawing your blood, is an important thing to consider. I have people at home with me on a video doctor's visit, and I say, it's like, I think it much more benefits you in the here and now to stay home than it does to come in to a health center and have someone, you know, draw your blood. I think it's always a question of risk benefit, and I think the benefit is really low. Mm-hmm. Although the risk is, you know, present. So you can never quite quantify that exactly.
But it's important to the medical community because it helps them learn more about community spread and what else?
That's true. It helps us know a little bit about, you know, where these infections are occurring and in what kind of people these antibody responses are made. It's true that, you know, the antibody response is not the same among everyone. And some people develop really robust levels of antibodies, and some people develop really piddling amounts of antibodies, and it's unclear how much that helps or hurts them. There's a lot of thought during, with this virus that, the immune response has a big part to play in how people get ill or make it to the intensive care unit or die. So I think that research will all certainly be very important. I think when these tests are rolled out, it's a question of like, who do we get these blood tests for? I can maybe imagine that someone's going to mine the rest of the data from, random citizens walking into the clinic. But in all honesty, the way studies are usually done is more so, you get approached by a researcher, they have you sign some papers that say, are you willing to be in the study? And then you have your blood drawn, and that sort of allows them to control for many variables rather than the sort of volunteer bias of people deciding on their own to get the antibody test. I don't mean to minimize the antibody test too much. It will be really important for research, but it's a question of context too.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So we spoke to you, say, 6 weeks ago. Have you been in clinic? Have you been doing research? What have you been working on since then?
So I'm MedPeds. I'm internal medicine pediatrics in Farmington Health Center for the university. So what I've been doing is finding or trying, basically just sending people to get tested in the mobile testing tents that we have outside of most of our university health centers. And also just trying to make sure that people don't neglect the rest of their healthcare during this. And that's been sort of another interesting phenomenon of the pandemic is doctor's offices saw a huge drop off in everything, even non-related to COVID. And we know that there's a lot of, blood pressure that's not being treated, diabetes that's not being treated, and trying to, coax people back into the clinic, teaching a lot of, people to use Zoom and various other video platforms to do their doctor's visits has been a lot of what I've been doing. I previously was working in the tents directly, and then we developed algorithms such that our wonderful RN staff could work the tents all by themselves, and we have massive throughput on the tents. So now my job has become a lot of basically Zoom meetings, much like we are having now.
Oh, lots of fun. Well,
right.
It's so interesting, and I think about that. I've thought about that, with my doctor, who I typically see a couple times a year. But, so much is sort of determined by your blood tests that you get. That you're looking at all these different factors, and I feel like, if I was on a telehealth meeting with my doctor, I would be saying, "Oh well, I feel pretty good, and I don't know, my hip hurts a little bit." It seems kind of inconclusive.
I think we're all sort of learning together as far as the remote health. But I think what I've experienced in, doing medicine remotely is that a lot of the fluff gets cut away. I think we were talking even prior to this, it was like discovering the things that we can kind of do without. And, previously we would get, a panel of standard labs because, here you are, you're in the clinic. We might as well get them now. Let's check your kidney function because you're on a blood pressure medicine. So that makes sense. But when you boil it down to the, strictly symptoms or patient complaints, my job becomes different and it's faster and somehow easier. And I feel more satisfaction out of the patients that I'm not usually pushing a lot of, things on them that they didn't necessarily come there for today. So, it's certainly, been interesting. And I think the other, part that it's, been, hard to deal with and interesting to watch is been the dramatic drop off in patients in a lot of doctor's offices. And, on a national scale, what you see is that people who work in large organizations like myself, like the university and or say Intermountain, have been doing more okay, but private practice doctor's offices are often have been going out of business because people have been, rightly so, quarantining at home. But you know, we have no sort of like financial machine to keep doctors afloat while this has all been going on. So there's been this scramble to try to make video visits work and to make phone visits work and to convince insurance companies that we're still doing some medical care through this. And the insurance companies, interestingly, are still collecting premiums and just not paying out as much. So what you end up with is insurance companies making really large profits and doctors sitting idle. So,
wow, you make a really interesting point about, you know, at the end of the day, a doctor that has a private practice is a small business person. And, you know, how many of these small offices, you know, are the doctors applying for the PPP, for example?
Right. I mean, I can't speak to exact numbers on that, but there was a New York Times article that had, like, had an estimation of something like 50,000 private practice primary care docs might go out of business, which is a scary prospect in a time when we as a nation are going to be really sick and less doctors will be on the job to take care of us. So that's a systemic issue that I don't have any power over, but been watching it happen.
Well, indeed. I mean, so much that we haven't known all along from the beginning of this, you know, what we knew 2 months ago and what we knew now is just layer upon layer upon layer of new information that, you know, we really couldn't have looked forward and guessed at before. And so guessing at it going forward and how the healthcare industry is going to evolve and transform from here on out is you know, at best guesswork, right? But very interesting to think about.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, because you're in pediatrics and because in the last couple of days, I've noticed a couple of articles coming forth about looking at, you know, how children are getting actually a lot more sick than we thought from COVID-19. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of those articles stemmed from multi-system inflammatory syndrome, which is still being a little pinned down in terms of its exact definition and its exact frequency. But in essence, what it is a really dramatic immunological response. So much like we were talking about previously, some of the health problems with COVID are related to how vigorously our immune system reacts. For reasons unclear, some children have developed this syndrome, which involves, you know, single or multi-organ failure and really high markers of inflammation in the blood as well as fever. The rates of this are low, really low, to the point where it's not something I usually advise the general population about. So really, really tough to say what difference this would make in the, you know, international makeup of, COVID. What we have seen so far is that, you know, in really black and white terms, the number of deaths in kids, the number of cases in kids has been just astronomically lower than adults, or, you know, in any age range, or, you know, specifically the very elderly. So if this syndrome is a real player, which it probably is, it doesn't seem to be big enough to tip the scales towards like a pediatric public health crisis, that's for sure. But it is certainly interesting and somewhat akin to, and has been often related to, Kawasaki disease, which is a known syndrome that we think also is usually post-viral. It is, you know, an overactive immune response to a virus that often doesn't get identified. Kawasaki disease has been out there for a long time, and that doesn't get the same attention, obviously. But I think, you know, more to come on this, of course, but I am not, you know, concerned for my pediatric patients you know, immediately, because the rate is that low.
Yeah. Well, it seems, and that's wonderful to hear. It seems like each time I hear about Well, in the beginning, we heard that this is really most dangerous for the elderly and those with underlying symptoms and those with, compromised immune systems. Then we'll hear something that comes from, you know, an age group that we're in. And it underscores the thought that none of us want to get this. None of us. You know, you hear someone's, scar tissue on the lungs and they're going to have compromised lung capacity for who knows how long, you know, maybe the rest of their lives. It just seems to, like, the cycle of kind of the information that's coming forth on this tends to just hit that home every time for someone who's not in a scary age range, who's very healthy. And, you know, the latest thing is I talked to a friend of mine yesterday who said that she came up with COVID toe. And I had seen these toe lesions maybe 10 days ago in the news. And I thought, oh, certainly this can't be real. And she had it. She did ended up testing negative, but she had that symptom. So I don't know. Strange.
I think COVID toe is my personal favorite COVID symptom of them all. It is super interesting. Red lesions on the tips of the toes. It's been reported by dermatologists in spades in New York. Yeah, in terms of, like, how do we interpret our own personal risk? I think that's a really important question. And, you know, I know I was sort of downplaying the risk to kids, but there is a risk to kids. It's just our perception of these statistics. And I think, you know, when you take an utterly massive amount of infected people and you say, well, that's okay, only 1% of them will die in this age range, that's still going to turn out to be hundreds or thousands of people that are in a low risk age range, right? There have been pediatric deaths. They are, you know, so far less than the, you know, nursing care or like nursing center deaths, but they exist. And, you know, I think a lot of us sort of, you know, like, so I'm a parent, I have two small kids at home, and I think about my risk of exposing them all the time. And I, you know, depends on what kind of day I had to how I think about that to say, it's like, oh, well, the risk is low because, you know, they're healthy children with no medical problems. Or, well, you know, it doesn't matter. The risk is low. If you're that 1 in 1,000, seems pretty high, right? Like, so
yeah.
I have no good consolation for anybody. I think that we should all take care of ourselves and be really vigilant and also think about the grandma who is going to touch that doorknob after you, and you are protecting her just as much. So I think, you know, whether we are afraid for our own health or feeling more confident in our own health waxes and wanes every day. And I think as the news cycles grind on and as this pandemic grinds on, we risk complacency and acceptance of a certain level of risk or a certain number of deaths. And I am, you know, regardless of what happens with businesses and politicians saying it's like the virus has not changed. You know, the virus is still out there and the virus can still hurt you no matter where you are, you know, what your health looks like.
Right. Well, very interesting conversation. And I thank you so much for joining us. And the final question I have, because I know everyone has it, there are several antibody tests that have been approved by the FDA or are recommended tests. And if people are looking out for them and they're insisting that they go get an antibody test, what are the correct tests? Or what is the one that the University of Utah Healthcare and Intermountain, I know Intermountain in this pilot study that they're doing with 10,000 people across the four counties where in Utah, where it has the highest incidence, what are those tests called?
So there's really only one option in the University of Utah, and it is just referred to as the COVID antibody test. More accurately, it would be referred to as the COVID IgG test. There's multiple types of antibodies. The IgG is the one we're looking for. Hypothetically, you could test for IgM or other things, but those are not really commercially scaled up. You may hear about them at some point in the future, you know, and give it another 6 weeks, we might be talking about it. But at this point, if you ask for a COVID antibody test, in the Intermountain or university system, and there's really the one option. So.
Okay, the IGG.
Yes.
No. Okay, wonderful. Dr. Matthew Shabbat, again, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time and continued best of health to you. Thank you for serving on the front lines as you are.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks. It was great to be here.